For too many of us, it's become safer to retreat into our own bubbles, whether in our neighborhoods or on college campuses or places of worship, or especially our social media feeds. Surrounded by people who look like us and share the same political outlook and never challenge our assumptions. And increasingly, we become so secure in our bubbles that we start accepting only information, whether it's true or not, that fits our opinions, instead of basing our opinions on the evidence that is out there. In the course of a healthy debate, we prioritize different goals and the different means of reaching them. But without some common baseline of facts, without a willingness to admit new information and concede that your opponent might be making a fair point, if you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life.
It'd be too easy to talk about nothing, to talk about nothing. Be too easy to talk like I'm something. I'm balling, I'm stunting. Be too easy, chasing the fame. Playing the game, it'll be too easy. But tell them we don't feel that. No, no, tell them we don't feel that.
Well, hey, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. I am your host, Calvin Moore, and per usual, I am here with my co-host, Kent Strait. What's up, Kent?
I am in such a good mood today.
You are in a good mood. Why?
I am in a good mood because, well, all right, as we sit here and we tape this, it is 5:09 p.m. on November 1st, meaning yesterday was what?
It was Halloween.
It was. That's not a part of the story. The day before was Monday, October 30th, and that was what?
All Hallows' Eve.
No, Halloween is in fact All Hallows Eve.
Okay, I don't know.
It could have been Devil's Night, depending on where you grew up.
Not here anymore.
But two things. One, it was the 500th anniversary of the Reformation.
Yes.
I am not
nailed
Catholic.
It.
Which actually happened on the 31st, didn't it?
I thought it was the 31st. Reformation Day is the 31st.
Great. Okay, so screw that up. Okay, so.
Okay.
More important, it was Indictment Monday, the beginning of the end. And I've been in a good mood ever since.
I don't think it will be the beginning of the end. We impeached Bill Clinton, and he won a second term.
Yes,
he was fine.
Bill Clinton was.
He was in a second term, though.
He was in a second term.
I was still, yes. But okay. Either way, all that stuff was out before he was impeached.
Still in a good.
Shouldn't
mood.
Shouldn't have won.
Can't
and won
a
second term.
Me.
Okay.
Nope.
All right.
No, I'm. Feeling
I mean, there
great
were people. There were people on both sides, though, that were indicted. That's the thing.
Nope.
There's conservatives, and there was a Republican and a Democrat.
Not
who got,
Monday.
Oh, not Monday. Okay, so we had to wait till Tuesday.
No, there's only been three indictments.
I'm pretty sure one of them was on our side.
There've been two indictments and a guilty plea, all from people on the Trump campaign.
Oh, okay.
There was somebody from the other side who stepped down from their position.
Yes, because he was implicated.
I don't know.
Okay.
However, more entertaining than his indictment was the guy who pled guilty. His name was George Papadopoulos. For any child of the 80s, that's Webster's dad.
Dad. Stepdad.
And I haven't heard anybody – stepdad, thank you. And I haven't heard anybody mention it.
What I need to understand is –
There's already a meme out
on it. Oh, is there? Okay. Yeah.
Since this is not visual, you guys can't see what's happening right now. I need to understand, why do you have pie – you have pie
– multiple.
Spatulas. You have got three pie spatulas in your hand.
They were in here last week.
I don't understand.
And they haven't left. I don't know.
All right.
Anyway.
Well, it is November 1st, which
Happy
officially
Halloween.
Makes it officially makes it the beginning of the season where we forget that there's a holiday before Christmas.
Yes.
So,
All Saints Day. I haven't heard anything about that today.
Well, you know.
Nor do I know what it is.
Is there a conspiracy?
No Saints. No Saints for me.
That doesn't say so on my Starbucks.
So, it's been a couple weeks, been a few weeks since we recorded. We did record an episode last week, full disclosure. That is not going to see the light of day just because some stuff came on in that episode that just
probably let's just
wasn't
say it was bad.
It wasn't appropriate.
We
for the
did
show.
A bad job.
Yeah,
okay.
I did a bad job.
Okay,
Kent did fine.
Okay,
but Kent, you told a story last week.
Yeah.
That because we are not letting that album, episode out.
Uh huh.
I want you to tell this story again because it's a Halloween centric story.
I think
it's hilarious.
I just think it's a cute little story.
But talk faster this time, because now we have guests.
Okay, all right. So, so real quick. So I like Halloween. I like the season. I like everything about it. I like the, you know, it's just the general spooky atmosphere. I like full moons. I like hoot owls, all that stuff. So I thought, what? So I've got three nieces, only two of whom factor into this story. But and they are one is the older is pushing 10 and a half and the other is 6 and a half. And I thought, let's you know, really get them this year to feel the fun of the Halloween season. So I found this book called – it's actually a three-pack of books that were very popular when I was a kid called Spooky Stories to Tell in the Dark or Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Which I don't remember.
You don't?
I do, though.
Okay.
Do.
Steve remembers. We haven't introduced our guest, by the way, but those are the other two voices.
We've been chiming in here.
Okay, yes. Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. And they are – it's a collection of you know, spooky Halloween-type stories, mostly drawn from like campfire stories or urban legends, folklore. So
you mean like the podcast lore, which is great, which is also now a show.
I have not listened to it.
On Amazon Prime.
So – So I thought, you know what, as a...
I'm Aaron Mankey, and this is Lore.
I gotta listen to the show.
You do.
Yeah,
it's great.
I gotta listen to the show. So I thought, you know what, I'm gonna pick out a couple of these stories, and I guess it was like a week and a half ago. I thought, let's tell them to the girls as bedtime stories. So... they have, the two of them over the last, I don't know, like year, especially the younger, all, you know, asked me, you know, tell me a ghost story. Tell me a ghost story. Love ghost stories. So I thought, all right, well now, you know, I've got some good ones to pick from. So before they went to bed, I said, all right, go upstairs. I will come up and I'll read you some stories. They were really excited about this idea. So I got up there. The two of them were in the older one's room. And they were sitting together on her bed under the covers. Cutest thing. So I sit at the foot of the bed and I start to read the first story. And the first story...
Pause for a second.
Yeah.
So Kent told the story last week.
Yeah.
And he told me the story before we did it on the show last week. And I was like, oh, you have to tell that on the show last week. Yeah. Kent has told this story several times at this point because almost every beat for beat... You were just telling the story.
Was he waving around knives too last night?
There were no knives.
Okay.
But it's almost like the breaths, the pauses, they're all the same.
Know.
It's
okay.
Great.
He's
okay, continue.
So, all right, so
I felt like I had to throw something in there for variety.
So I'm sitting there at the foot of the bed, and I'm not going to tell you the whole story because it's long, but the first story that I started to read, I got about 20 seconds into it, and... I got about 20 seconds into it, and the line appears, the babysitter called the father and said, is it okay if I change rooms? The clown statue is freaking me out. When I said that line, the older of the girls, very calmly, swung her legs off the bed, got up, headed toward the door of her own room, I might add, headed toward the door. I called after her. I said, hey, come back. From the doorway, I heard, nope. and I said, you don't want to hear the end of the story? And she said, I know what you do. I'm not a big fan of jump scares. So, and this story did not even feature a jump scare. Now, there is a quasi, a very short quasi sequel to that story, in that I was at their house two nights ago on Halloween Eve, and I had the books, and I had the books, and so I said, the girls were separated; they were on different floors, and I said to the older one, I said, "This is Halloween Eve. This is kind of your last chance. Wouldn't it be great to get in a scary story?" And she was like, "No, no, no, I don't want to hear it. I have trouble with nightmares, whatever." And I said, okay, well, tell your sister. So she disappears, goes up the stairs. I don't hear her ask the question, but I hear the younger one's little voice from the top of the stairs go, no. So I guess, long story short, I guess it's an effective book of Halloween folklore.
Okay. Well, my Halloween was a lot less I guess my Halloween was kind of lackluster. I was raised in a way that Halloween was considered – it was never stated this way, but it was clearly the implications that it was the one day a year that Satan got more power than Jesus. And by handing out candy to children dressed as Power Rangers, you were complicit in you know, in working with the devil.
Hey, look, it's Iron Man. Satan's winning.
Yeah, Satan's winning, everybody. So I wasn't allowed to celebrate Halloween my entire life. And then I got older, and I was like, oh, you know, I don't want to really do anything. So I was on a college campus, so there were no kids around. And then I moved downtown Detroit, and I lived in a, you know, an apartment building, so I was on the fifth floor, so there's no kids coming through on that. And then I lived with my mother-in-law, and their houses were too far apart, so nobody was coming down that street. So now I'm married, got this house on a nice little cul-de-sac. We're like, oh my gosh, there's going to be kids everywhere. And this was the first Halloween for me at 38 years old that I'm going to be able to give out candy. I'm super excited. It was more about me than the kids. So 6 o'clock rolls around. Get here, knock at the door. I go running. I'm like, honey, get out. My wife's on her phone. I'm like, come on. So we open the door. This cute little black girl there, and she's a little princess. I'm like, oh, take some candy. So she took like two pieces of candy. I was like, yeah, you can take more. She's like, no, I want to leave some for more people. I'm like, oh, you're so cute. Bless your heart. So she leaves. An hour and a half goes by, and then another couple with their kids shows up, and they take a little bit of candy. And that was it. We had so much candy that I actually brought some here to the studio tonight to just give away. Thank you. There's some of it now. Oh, no, I didn't bring those. But okay. I brought a lot of candy.
Was it raining? Is that an effect?
No, it was. But apparently, I guess kids are strategic about what's the streets they go on.
They know.
And all the lights on our street were out except for ours. So none of the kids were going to bypass to come over to the one house that was lit.
Got
to
be efficient.
Yeah. And so we were sad.
When I was a kid, I was actually told I couldn't go trick-or-treating, but not for religious reasons. My dad thought that trick-or-treating was begging, and no son of his was going to go begging for candy.
Wow.
So he gave me $5 and said, go with your mom to the grocery store.
Hardcore!
Yes, he objected on bourgeois grounds.
See, my mom and dad disagree. My mom was a religious reason. My dad was just like, I don't trust my neighbors any other day of the year. Why am I going to send my kids to them?
Well,
The
nice thing is that the local hospital would X-ray all the candy if you brought it in, which of course made it radioactive.
Yeah,
and
no,
so there was other issues.
Candy.
But then when my sister finally, who's 11 years younger than I am, asked my dad, you know, can I go trick-or-treating? He's like, of course, my princess. Here, take your sister trick-or-treating. It all of a sudden lost its bourgeois tag.
Of course. Right.
Did you happen to see, land the Halloween plane here, I guess. Did you happen to see Donald Trump Jr.'s tweet?
No.
From this morning,
no.
I believe.
Oh, yes, I saw that.
So it was a picture of, I don't know, his daughter. She looks maybe five. And it's a picture of this little girl holding a pail of candy. And his tweet said, so I told Chloe I'm going to take half her candy and give it to the kids who stayed home last night to teach her about socialism. The response was kind of epic. My favorite one was celebrated English author J.K. Rowling, who said, what you should do is what you should do is give her a large bucket of 60-year-old candy. Explain to her it's what's left over from what her great-grandfather made. And there would be a lot more, except Grandpa is stupid and lost a lot of it.
Wait a minute. Maybe how about this? I'll give you 50 pieces of candy if you do the dishes. And then when she does the dishes, he gives her 5 and doesn't pay the rest.
And doesn't pay the rest. Yeah, so, yes. I was not happy with the results.
Wow. That's hilarious. Okay. So speaking of kind of landing the plane, my mom, of course, had to get a little dig in. I love my mom, but... she'd invited us out to the harvest party. Harvest party for those of you who aren't religious, specifically Christian religious. Christians like to have harvest parties in lieu of celebrating Halloween.
I do have to ask though. She realizes that Halloween is a Christian invention, right?
It doesn't matter.
Would this be the equivalent of the Muslim Halloween, which is the simulacrum?
That's almost as good as Halloween.
Basically, you can dress up in costumes as long as they're not scary. They're not. They're not demonic, you know. Oh, they're not demonic like Dracula. Like Dracula's demonic. Dracula is fictional. Just so we're aware on that. Just so we're clear on that. Vampires don't exist. But
says you.
So my sister, my sister's daughter. So my niece was participating in the harvest festival at her church last night, and she did a speed painting.
Speed.
So,
oh, speed, yeah. Okay.
So
sure.
The amount of from the beginning to the end of the song, she had to paint on canvas.
And I'll bet if you turn it upside down, you see Jesus.
I asked her if she was going to do it upside down. She didn't do it upside down. Yeah. But she did it in front of like 3,000 people, which is really, really cool. So,
right.
But my mom, of course, goes on Facebook and is like, oh, only two kids showed up. I guess you should have come and seen your niece paint. Like, oh, mom, I love you, but I hate you at the same time. But that being said, this week we are going to we're beginning a five part series. I'd say 5 week series, but we're getting into the holidays, so we might take a few weeks off. But we are getting into a 5 part series called The First, and we are looking at the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. So we are going to be looking at today we're going to be looking at the freedom of religion. So each week it's freedom of religion, then we'll be doing freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom to assemble, and then freedom to redress the government, which apparently is lobbying. I didn't know that until I had a conversation with Kent about that. So,
by the way, it probably won't be a 5 week series. I just have to say right now, 3 weeks from tonight, Thanksgiving Eve, not coming. So we probably won't do a show.
It'll be probably only about part, 20 minutes.
Okay, yeah, five part, not 5 week series. Five part. Yes, okay. I said that. You're not listening.
Very good.
Anyhow. So, this week we have two guests. We were supposed to have three, but, Kara Lividini Terzag, her husband, fell ill, so she stayed home to take care of him tonight. So we have, two guests who have been on the show, in the past. But first up, we have Mr. Saeed Khan. Saeed Khan is currently in the Department of History and a lecturer in the Department of Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan, where he teaches Islamic and Middle East history, and a bunch of other stuff about Muslims. Mr. Khan is also a research fellow at Wayne State University's Center for the Study of Citizenship. He is also adjunct professor in Islamic studies at the University of Detroit Mercy and at Rochester College, co-teaching a course on Muslim-Christian diversity. Saeed, welcome back to the line.
Thanks for having me back, Kelvin.
And then Mr. Steve Phelps is a father and husband. Wait, where did you write this out? Did you write out this one? Okay. All right. Just making sure. All right.
Still he's a father.
All right. Husband, father and I just, it looked the same length as the last one.
Oh, okay.
Steve came on.
You only
like,
gave me a minute.
I did. So Steve Phelps is a father and husband from Madison Heights with a bachelor's in political science. He spent 12 years in health insurance field before moving over to life insurance. Steve is a local musician who performs under the name Memphis Hawk, who is highly sensitive to the fact that his biography is far less substantial than other guests. I did only give you a minute to write it out. So, Steve, welcome to the line.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You know, and here's the interesting thing. I do this show, and I have the bios of the people that are on the show, and I'm often intimidated as well. Or I'm like, oh, my God, they're so impressive. But then I have people who don't have the long bio, but they're some of the smartest people that are ever on the show. And I always love when you're here. So I'll just say that right now.
I like being here. So thank you for having me.
So, that being said, you're welcome. We are talking about,
the First Amendment.
The First Amendment. And we are talking about, the freedom of religion this week.
We should have a 5 part series on the Third Amendment. I don't see that one coming.
It keeps probably not coming.
Yeah.
Right. We could, no. Anyhow, so first question. Can you briefly describe your relationship, with religious faith? Either one of you.
Okay. So I will say, to generalize, I would say, I adhere to the Christian faith, though with an asterisk. And I say that because for the last 2,000 years, the church, Christian church has definitely taken on a whole lot of personalities. We have a lot of, especially politicians, I guess these days, who, you know, claim Christianity is their faith, but it's very foreign to the way I see it. So for any Christian today to just say I'm a Christian, but not parse that, I don't think it's exactly accurate, so I'm going to say if we're going to generalize, I do it, you know, adhere to the Christian faith, but obviously it's a little more nuanced than that. Just like if you have 10 people line up and say I'm a Christian, they're going to probably have kind of 10 different points of view on that. But for the point of this, I would say that Jesus of Nazareth, words of, you know, of his faith would be what I would adhere to.
Okay. What about you, Saeed?
Well, as a Muslim, I would go ahead and say that I'm a practitioner. Observant, whatever that means. I mean, there's a whole spectrum regarding that. And always trying to make sure that my relationship to Islam is not just a social identity marker. I find that it's all too common now for people to simply reduce their relationship with faith to simply be a call sign or a namesake.
Okay. Yeah, my relationship with faith is I was raised in Black Pentecostalism on Sunday mornings. So, and by Sunday mornings, I mean Sunday, because it just went forever.
Yeah.
we played a little game seeing, how many times we could count the pastor saying, I'm almost finished. I believe our record was 19 times, 5 hours later. But so Sunday mornings in church, Sunday evenings in church, Wednesday evenings, we've talked about this on the show before, Kent, part of the Awana program. So for any of you that are out there that are evangelical Christian, you know that means Baptist for the most part. So Pentecostal on Sunday mornings, Baptist on Wednesday evenings, because they had all the youth programs. Went on for religious degrees as well. Saw myself going into ministry, worked in youth ministry for a number of years. So definitely adhere to the Christian faith. And I hear you, Steve, on that for sure, the Christianity with the asterisk. I probably have less of an asterisk until more recently, you know, the more recent election, just kind of my faith being lost in a lot of people. But in terms of talking about these things that matter, you know, we're talking about your eternal destiny in the end, I guess. What's the end game? You know, what is the meaning of life? I would adhere fairly strongly to the words of Christ, you know, Christian scripture, but then also to I would differentiate from there a Christian worldview as well. You know, how do we bring this religious faith to bear on philosophy and politics and history and economics? So I try to view the entire world through this Christian lens. I do it imperfectly, for sure. But if there was if we're talking about my relationship with religious faith, it's not a, you know, as you were saying, Saeed, just a, you're trying not to make something just a cultural marker, right? Hey, I'm a Christian because I'm American and that's the majority. It really does mean something to me. And I would doggedly defend what it means against people who are just kind of very lackadaisical and say, oh, my opinion is really what Christianity truly is. I'm like, well, there's more to it than that. But Kent, yourself?
Well, I am a lifelong Christian, and as I can and I'm happy to say, it's good to have you back because you had a toothache a few months ago and it caused all kinds of trouble.
Yeah. And I met a lot of Muslims, and they were trying to covertly get me into the faith.
There was.
No, I'm kidding.
How many of them were dentists?
I would have done it. I have what I consider to be a stereotypical and conventional white suburban Christian upbringing. My parents went to a Baptist church at the time I was born. My first time in church was at 4 weeks old, and that was only because mom had a C-section and needed a couple weeks, or else it would have been probably 2 weeks. And was in Sunday school from age that to when the church I went to stopped having Sunday school when I was about 25, 26, and 27.
Younger than that,
26, something like that. Anyway, so so yeah, I went to Sunday school for 25, 26 years straight, and have never left. I've been a member of three churches, and am something of a and I am I remain a member of the church that I went to that I joined 19 years ago. Not feeling a particularly strong connection to the evangelical Protestant denomination in the past year, but still around.
Okay.
So. Okay. So let's go with the second question. Oh, it's bullet points this time. See, that's the problem.
So, it was an accident.
All right. So the beginning of the First Amendment to the Constitution reads as follows. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. How do you interpret this?
Go first. Mine? Okay. I would say, this is Saeed, that what it essentially says is that the state cannot go ahead and create a religion, nor can it, and I think that this has to be qualified, place unreasonable limitations on religious expression. And while the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law, I think it's important to recognize that this also passes to the states through the 14th Amendment.
Right. Yep. Okay. Absolutely does. Steve, anything to add?
I would say I kind of view it at through the lens of what was happening during the Articles of Confederation and during colonial times, that you know, taxes were collected to pay ministers in some states. In some states, you could be persecuted, you could be locked up for not adhering to the you know, basically the religion of your state, of your town. So when I look at this, basically I'm looking at a reaction by, you know, by Madison, by people who kind of came from this background, that they didn't want to see, first of all, people being thrown in jail for not practicing a state religion, but they also didn't want to see taxation go toward to paying ministers. So I kind of, you know, I don't always, you know, see eye to eye of, you know, with Jefferson and Madison. But I think in this case, I kind of look at it that way, and that basically, you know, you shouldn't be held – your opinion of your religious beliefs should not be held against you. I think Jefferson said at one point, if he doesn't break my leg or steal money from my pocket, what is it of me to, yep, you know, be concerned with how you feel about your religion? So I kind of look at it that way.
And a historical footnote, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison did not see eye to eye, literally. One was very tall, the other very short.
What about you, Kent? Your thoughts?
I think everything that was just said has – I mean, how do I interpret it? The government can't – well, here's a question, and I'm sad that Kara had to bow out, because she would have been the constitutional scholar, mm-hmm, on the topic as an attorney. I would like to have asked, because we are in a something of a – in the last 30 years, a new era of a textualism in examining the Constitution, ever since Antonin Scalia was appointed to the court. When the amendment reads, Congress shall make no law, how would textualists say that doesn't say the president can't sign an executive order? I don't know if that's legitimate or not. I don't know if Congress in that case means the federal government or if it means Congress.
Well, I think there have been a lot of cases that have come down from the Supreme Court that would – keep that from happening.
I would hope so.
Yeah. Okay. Just in the bare bones research I was doing to kind of shore up having this conversation, there were a bunch of decisions about freedom of religion that have come down from SCOTUS over the years that I think would certainly limit the presidential powers to just do that.
And I think that also kind of jives with some of the founders' considerations about the Bill of Rights in general, mm-hmm, that if we enumerate one law or we enumerate one right – you know, would that leave people to interpret it? I think Hamilton in 84, Federalist 84, said something along the lines of, if we, you know, if we say, I think, you know, mentioning freedom of the press as an example, you know, first of all, if we say that the government doesn't have a right to do this, are we saying the government ever had a right to do this? Isn't it we the people in the first place? And secondly, that he was concerned that people would say, well, if we say this specifically, then people can, you know, over the years can be able to misinterpret that to kind of make it into whatever they want. In this case, I think that would jive with what you were saying about, you know, an executive order versus a law created by Congress.
Was Hamilton one who was – and I've heard that there were founders who were – was Hamilton one who was against the idea of the Bill of Rights?
Yes.
Because we shouldn't enumerate – okay.
Yeah, basically the idea of we the people are the ones in charge anyway. Who are we to say that the government had any right – to be able to take away our freedom of press? Why do we have to come up? So, and you know, obviously there were founders on both sides of that debate, and I can see both sides myself, but I mean, that was one of the considerations.
Well, and I mean, a lot of the discussions now are academic regarding those two long forgotten amendments, 9 and 10. 9 being what Congress doesn't do is reserved, or is unenumerated, and then 10 being those reserved for the states. I mean, of course, for many people, they can't get past the Second Amendment, so.
And this is kind of where things get a little interesting for me, trying to interpret these kinds of things as a historian, someone who who's my background is looking at the early American Republic. So looking at, you know, the Continental Congress, you know, when they put together the Articles of Confederation, you know, what was missing from the Constitution? Why do we need to put amendments in? Those kinds of things. And so when I look at this and then I look at the practices, this is where as a historian, it gets a little dicey because, yes, we had written into laws and codified into law, you know, Congress is not going to, you know, we're not going to establish a religion. That's essentially what they wrote, right? But then you saw in practice the things that they were doing that were very much establishing religion. And maybe in 2017, with all the people decrying that we're getting further and further away from our Christian roots, and we'll get to that on the second half of the show, maybe we're getting closer and closer to what that document said, whether they meant it or not. Because, for instance, the U.S. Capitol building, for years, every Sunday was used as a church. Every Sunday was used as a church. So you've got the place where these laws are drawn up, where this Constitution – well, I guess it wasn't drawn up in that building. But enshrined in this building is the ideals of that Constitution, right? And they are using that same building not to establish any particular religion, but we're definitely putting out there what we lean hard into. And so for me, when I look at the First Amendment, how do I interpret it? Maybe I'm a textualist when – and I'm going to be going to law school in the fall, so maybe in a few years I'll be like, I was totally not a textualist when I answered that question. But I'm reading, what does it say? Okay, make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Is there an established church by the government? Is there an established religion by the government that people must adhere to, pay taxes into? No, there is not. Prohibiting the free exercise thereof, we'll get into that a little bit later, because there's differences that people have as to what is prohibiting my free exercise. But for the most part, I just read what it says. The way I interpret it is the government shouldn't make a church and they shouldn't keep you from believing what you want to believe.
But at the same time, I think that it's without dispute that the government does help at least create the climate of America's civil religion. Now, whether that is oftentimes defined as the culture of America when it comes to religion or through such seemingly contradictory practices as having congressional convocation, the official recognition of Christmas as being a federal holiday. Some will go ahead and try to push that square peg into the round hole by justifying it, saying, well, this is really more of a civil religion. This is more of America being America, either dependent on the majority or that this is something that everyone can celebrate even in a secular way, which accommodates for that. There's no prohibition for Muslims, Jews, and Hindus to give gifts or even have a Christmas tree. It's not something exclusive with your Christian card. Or if you really want, you can go with what Bill O'Reilly said, that it's really not a religious holiday at all. It's celebrating the birth of Jesus Christ, that very famous philosopher.
So. Huh. Okay, and we'll get into that a little bit later as well. Let's.
Because no show is complete without a deep dive into Bill O'Reilly.
I was checking my watch. I didn't know when it was going to happen.
Caution.
I've got 7 pages of O'Reilly over here.
Okay, so Thomas Jefferson famously wrote to the Danbury Baptist Association in a private letter, quote, "Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legitimate powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should," quote, "make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof," unquote, thus building a wall of separation between church and state. This is where the popular phrasing comes from, never appearing in the Constitution itself. I realize I didn't ask a question here.
Right.
Interesting.
There was no question.
Just a long statement.
And Jefferson, by the way, was the tall one. Madison was the short one.
It didn't take me turn. Okay. So this is interesting in that we talk about the separation of church and state all the time. The words never appear in the Constitution. This is a private letter that has influenced public thought for some, you know, few hundred years now at this point. When you think about the separation of church and state, the question I wanted to ask here is, do you believe that the practice of religion in the United States should be free from government influence, and do you believe that the government should be free from religious influence?
I would say in general, yes, to both questions. That first of all, I think to those who are faithful, you don't necessarily want a government to be telling you how to practice your faith when it comes to your own private practices that don't affect other people. I guess I think Jefferson considered your religious opinions You know, now obviously we've come to a point where that kind of manifests itself differently. If you make a cake for a wedding, you know, obviously, you know, that's just when commerce comes in, it does start to cross that line. And I think it's a little hazy there. In the case of Jefferson, he was just talking about political opinions or religious opinions. When it comes to, you know, well, you know, should the state have a particular religion? I think it hinders the growth of the country when you declare, you know, we are this or we are that, because you're basically saying this small group over here is welcome and everyone else is, you know, just an other, someone who's, you know, basically just a visitor to what's going on here. So I don't think it's good for the country or for the individual to have either one kind of cross over.
Okay. I think it's important, though, to recognize that the issue of being able to, in practical terms, separate what really amounts to private conduct and the public sphere is becoming more and more elusive. Technology, communications, voluntary blurring of the line means that where one's private space traditionally, which used to be the front door of one's house, and ends, and where does public space begin, is very difficult to discern right now. I mean, thanks to the internet, satellite mm-hmm. television, it is literally closer to you than something on the outside of your front door. And in practical terms as well, this idea of a false wall that exists between church and state. One cannot expect in a democracy people to just sort of check their religion at the door, right, especially if it's a very totalistic way of being. At the same time, I think it's very important to move away from the essentialization of America being a particular religious persuasion, especially when it comes to the Protestantism. The Pew Center for the Study of Religious Life has determined as recently as 4 years ago that the United States, for the first time in its history, is no longer a majority Protestant nation. Well, if there is this idea about letting the marketplace decide, will those people go gently into that quiet night and let either Catholicism or none, N-O-N-E, as a religion, take over? And it seems as though many of the culture wars right now are punctuated with the idea that those who are finding themselves ever increasingly in the minority don't want to cede that authority that they have.
Now, this for me is kind of I wrote the question, so I guess the way that I'm thinking through this is, I guess I'm 50-50 on this one. Do I want the government to come in and influence religion? No, I don't. I don't believe that's the role of religion. In that respect, I do agree with Thomas Jefferson's sentiment. On the other hand, I don't know that the Founding Fathers ever assumed that government could be created without religious influence. I mean, you can see it from all the writings of the early church fathers, even those who were deists. And I think the fact that the early church fathers were all deists is definitely overblown. Many of them were devout Christians, not evangelicals, because evangelical didn't exist at that time. But certainly men of deep faith. There were many of them who were and many of them who were not, despite their flaws and certainly owning people being one of those things. But just from the writings of people like Washington, of people even like Jefferson, who didn't believe in miracles and ripped them all out of his Bible, there were and Lincoln. These were men who said
the famous founding father.
He's not a founding father, Lincoln. Not okay. The founding father, but you know, 16th president of the United States. Either way, people who are no longer here, who have influenced the American journey, so to speak, political journey, were men of deep faith, who believe that faith was an integral part of life and could not view the existence of our government at all without the providential hand of some God, right? They always use that word providence as code. But either way, I'm of the mindset that I do believe that religion ought to influence government. To what degree? We can go back and forth on that, but one of the two of you said no one can be expected to check their faith at the door by any means. And there are certain things, Steve, you were saying, insofar as it doesn't, hurt someone else, like the interesting thing about religions, whether you be Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, Jewish, it doesn't matter. It does talk about there are different moralities within these systems. So, yeah, you know what? Next door neighbor being gay and raising kids doesn't affect me at all, really. I mean, it doesn't. But if I'm bringing my faith to bear on that and I'm thinking, okay, morally, there's something going on here that, yeah, there's no physical reality that says that something bad is going on, but there is a philosophical moral reality that matters, right? In that case, religion coming to bear on government, I think, is something that is utterly unavoidable. Now, in a democracy, of course, if your religion – your religious point of view doesn't win out, then you got to live with that reality, right? There are a lot of Christians who lost out on the abortion debate, which is why it's legal in the United States at this point. SCOTUS came down with that.
And as we know, that debate is over and has been completely over for 40 years. Yeah.
But what I'm getting at is I think that religious faith, it's necessary for religious faith to influence government. I don't know to what degree, but even if it weren't necessary, I would say it's 100% unavoidable as well.
There's a something I grabbed from Jefferson here. This was written in the Statute of Religious Freedom in 1777. Basically, this was the blueprint for the First Amendment. This was for the state of Virginia. That the impious presumption of legislators and rulers, civil as well as ecclesiastical, who themselves but fallible and uninspired men, have assumed dominion over the faith of others, setting up their own opinions and modes of thinking as the only true and infallible, hath established and maintained false religions over the greatest part of the world. I think that's basically Jefferson saying, yeah, religion can have a positive effect on government, but the men who are in charge of that, I don't believe are infallible. And my fear is that
right.
They will have undue influence. So he would probably agree with you that, yeah, there can be a considerable amount of good that can happen when your own morality does influence the laws that you make. It's just which men and which laws.
Right. Absolutely.
Because
– And which you know. Religion. Because let's be honest. I mean, I can look at Christianity and Islam and go, look, there's a lot of similarities here in terms of, you know, where, you know, how we view the world morally. I mean, the Abrahamic faiths all pretty much kind of come down in the same places, at least morally. But there are some parts of departure. And so at that point, it's like, oh, no. You know, obviously, Christianity has enjoyed its day in the sun here in America. And so a lot of people are like, well, you know what? What if a Muslim came along? How would you feel about their faith being? And this is generally, again, liberals talking to conservative Christians. And, well, no, of course I wouldn't like that. That's crazy. And what's the Sharia law? We got to, you know, we got to be worried about that. That is, though. I mean, at bottom of that kind of fear is a concern of what do you do when two competing moralities come into play that are both from a religious standpoint and you both have a vote and you both are trying to influence government. That's where I'm going, okay, to what degree and how do we do this? How do we walk that fine line? And how do you determine whose morality is superior? Because I'm coming going, hey, Christianity's, you know, moral backbone is superior to everything else. And in reality, it could be a Muslim morality that is – you know, superior on a particular issue, or a Jewish morality, or a Buddhist morality that is superior and works better within the American system. I don't know.
I think that shows that the conversation is dynamic. It's not static. It's not this
Absolutely.
And only this. It's constantly that give and take of saying, you know, is in this situation versus that situation. And I think that's what's going to continue for, you know, the entirety of the Republic, however many months it has left.
But that's exactly it, is that if you believe in the dynamicism, it's the dynamicism of the process. What I think is the real challenge facing America today is the calcification, not of a process, but of a certain set of morals. And that is a function of people trying to preserve and protect their authority for all eternity. And when the demographics are shifting, that's causing a lot of problems because there's a lot of people who didn't get that memo to say, okay, well, we have to sign up and we have to freeze things right here.
Kent, your thoughts? Or do we move on to the next question?
We can probably move into the next question. Sure. I've got some thoughts, but I did want to say that Steve looked up some Thomas Jefferson. So did I. He was 6'2". James Madison, 5'4".
You know what?
5'4".
Move on. Let's go. Next question.
I mean, it really was quite a disparity.
We'll do one more question, then we'll take a break.
I have a feeling we're going to go out and start measuring statues now.
The Supreme Court has historically stated that, quote, laws are made for the government of actions, and while they cannot interfere with mere religious belief and opinions, they may with practices. For example, if one were part of a religion that believed in vampirism, the First Amendment would protect one's belief in vampirism but not the practice of vampirism. What are the reasonable limits the government should place on the practice of religious belief and why?
Well, the easy answer, which is obviously means it's not nearly enough of an answer. The easy answer is to where it affects your neighbor, it affects, you know, the guy across the street, the woman who lives above you on the second floor, and that you can have practices which mean, you know, you eat a cracker and you drink some wine and you say it's the blood and the body of Jesus and it means nothing to anyone at all. But once you start saying, and I also have to sacrifice my neighbor, you know, now you're getting to the kind of the territory of it's affecting somebody else. It's going to harm somebody else. Now, again, we mentioned earlier the whole thing about the bakery and, mm-hmm. you know, when commerce comes in, it does kind of muddy the waters, which is why I said it was the easy answer to say as soon as it affects somebody else. But, I mean, as a quick answer, I think that as soon as it goes into affecting the livelihood, the liberties of somebody else, you know, then it becomes a little different. It becomes, well, you know, obviously vampirism is going to affect your own civil rights. You know, sacrificing my neighbor is going to involve their civil rights, in which case it gets a little hazy. And, you know, obviously we say in those cases, well, absolutely not. You can't sacrifice your neighbor. But there is going to come that kind of that gray area of, well, yes, but I don't want to serve them in my diner.
Right.
You know, because it's against my religion. And who are you to say it's, you know, now we're involved. Well, do you have a license to have a diner in the city? Well, now, you know, you kind of have to adhere to the laws of the land and that's what respect.
Right. And you've got things like child is sick, needs a blood transfusion. We don't believe in blood transfusions. Now you're endangering
vaccines,
the life of the child,
sure.
Right? Anti-vaccination, although that doesn't have to have a religious – and I don't think that really does have a religious underpinning. It's just bad science, which a lot of
religious
people tend to adhere to. But that's not the point I'm trying to make on that. But you do have people who are like, hey, you know what? My family, my life, our faith, we believe this. This has happened. My daughter needs a blood transfusion. We want to put it in the hands of God, though. And child could get better. Child could also die. Right. And the government, I believe, has stepped in on several occasions saying, yeah, no, we have a duty to our citizens. Right. And so at this point, the fact that they are a citizen of this great of these great United States,
the state has a compelling interest.
Right.
Her life.
Yeah. That right usurps our duty, our compelling interest usurps your religious faith at this moment. And you'll thank us for it on the other side because your daughter's still here or your son's still here, right? That kind of thing. But yeah, the baker kind of thing, you know, compelling someone to do something that is against their faith, it does get muddy when money is involved, but it also gets muddy when people do have deep religious faith about certain things and you have to violate their religion. We're talking about contraception, making companies do that. There was something that just happened. When I was growing up, homeschooling was a thing, right? It's still a thing.
Yeah.
But it was a thing mm-hmm. back in the 80s. Like, there were people who were dead set against it. You know, these parents are not qualified to take care of their kids' educational needs. And of course, that's some intersectionality because it crosses over into the education sector. But a great deal of people that left the public school system and opted not to put their kids in a private school system did so out of religious alarmism. It is, I do not want my kid raised with being taught evolution. I do not want my kids around anybody who's gay because that's becoming a thing and they're teaching that in sex ed classes. And I think it's my right as a parent, a Christian parent, to teach my kids Christian sexual ethics. And so there was a huge religious underpinning underneath of this that brought a lot of the education and religion argument to the fore when this was argued in front of many, many state courts. I believe it ended up getting to the Supreme Court. And now the ship has kind of sailed on that. Homeschoolers are allowed to homeschool. You have to make certain benchmarks and things like that. But the federal government and state governments felt compelled, okay, your religious beliefs are now going to get in the way of the educational progress of these children. Now, most tests show that homeschool kids tend to test higher than kids who are in you know, public schools, but you know, they're often not prepared for the real world once they leave because it's culture shock. But those are the kinds of things where the government does step in and go, hey, you know, what's going on here. We have a compelling interest in this. So,
but I mean, if you've got consenting adults, let's say in the case of vampirism, who say yes, you're more than welcome to go ahead and bite my neck and extract some blood. How is that any different, or how is it worse than a parent speaking on behalf of his or her infant child and saying, "Yeah, sure, you know, doctor, take off the foreskin of my newborn male child"? I mean, it seems as though this idea that what passes for acceptable within society based on a religious grounds is really, really mercurial.
I don't think come to think of it, I think in the case of two consenting adults with vampirism, I don't think it would be a crime if
– No, it's – I don't think so either.
The giver
no,
were
it,
to –
That would be a crime.
But
it,
no.
It would definitely be a crime, because if someone – if you had two consenting adults and someone said, "I want you to kill me,"
yeah, it's
there
a different
are laws
story,
there are law, to bring harm to someone else even with their consent.
Sure.
There's a very fine line that the government has set their foot down on, which mm-hmm. is why things like BDSM are totally legal.
Yep.
Beating up your girlfriend is not.
No, but so, I think in the idea of two consenting adults where one drinks the other one's blood, not to the point of death, but to, you know, fulfill whatever their religious practice is, short of that, I think that would be acceptable.
Well, how about this? What about the idea that within an individual's faith tradition, smoking peyote is part of the sacrament? And we have, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court, which ruled in Employment Division versus Smith, an opinion written by none other than Antonin Scalia, that
they always were,
that peyote cannot be invoked along religious grounds to be consumed. So this idea then that there is clearly an encroachment of a Christian or a Judeo-Christian view on even what an individual does with a sincerely held belief with a religion that is indigenous to the United States shows at the very least a fallacy and at worst a hypocrisy.
Yeah, well, we've also broken every treaty with Native American nations.
Now, I have a question.
But there was, hold on, go on, one second, because there was another case that the Supreme Court spoke on. I don't know the name of it. I was just reading it today, though, about eagle feathers within Native American religious traditions. There is a special dispensation that Native American tribes got for eagle feathers, because eagles are protected species in the United States. And so there's these religious traditions that Native American tribes are given these special dispensations to use them. However, should you convert to a Native American religion, let's say that you're a white person or a black person, you're just enamored with Native American culture and you become part of their faith, they cannot give to you, you cannot participate in that sacrament,
yeah,
because you are not actually Native American. So it only extends to Native Americans, which is, and then that was challenged on racial lines, interestingly enough. Mm-hmm. But I find that kind of stuff interesting. These are kind of all these are the ley lines, and they're all just kind of zigzagging all over the place. There's really nowhere that it seems to make sense at the end of the day, I guess.
Now, what I was going to ask was, and I don't know the answer to this, during Prohibition, was it illegal to take the blood of Christ in a Catholic church if it was wine?
No.
Okay.
No, it was totally legal.
So totally legal for wine, not so much for peyote.
Yes, that's where the separation of church and state was very, very handy.
Once again, the difference between alcohol and other things that – yeah, okay.
Yeah. So I think that's a good place to take a break. We're going to take a 10-minute break, and we'll be back. Well, hey, everybody. Thanks so much for waiting on the line for us. We're going to dive right back into questions. So here we go. According to the Treaty of Tripoli, which was signed in 1796, quote, there's a lot of quotes this week. As the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, as it has in itself no character of enmity against the laws, religion, or tranquility of Muslimmen or Muslims, and as the said states never entered into any war or act of hostility towards any Mohammedan nation, it is declared by the parties that no pretext arising from religious opinions shall ever produce an interruption of the harmony existing between the two countries, unquote. In accordance with Article 6 of the Constitution, this treaty became incorporated as part of the supreme law of the land, a.k.a. the Constitution. While the treaty informs governmental policy today, it does not necessarily inform public opinion. Many Americans and other Western nations are distrustful of Muslims. Why do you think that is? And Saeed, obviously, for obvious reasons, I'm going to kick that over to you first.
I'm going to play coy and wonder what those obvious reasons are. Well, I think it's interesting that here we have the Treaty of Tripoli, 1796 under President John Adams. Article 11 says,
who immediately signed it when it came across his desk. This was unanimously voted
before
on.
Before the Senate, actually, I believe, even voted on it. He signed it and money was already sent over before we even voted on it.
That's right. And part of it is also important to recognize that the first foreign country to recognize the very nascent United States of America was, in fact, a Muslim country, Morocco.
Not to be that guy, but I believe the president in 1796 was George Washington.
I'm sorry, then okay. Let's go.
Okay, but I just
let's
you
go
know.
To Washington. No, I stand corrected. And how tall was he again?
James Madison.
You
know, James Madison signed this.
No. Adams signed it.
Was it? John Adams signed this. He was president in 96.
He was elected in 96. He didn't become president until 97.
Okay, well, he signed it either way.
We made a bad date, but it was Adams.
Okay, fine.
It was
okay.
Definitely
all right.
Adams.
Very good.
Okay.
All right. So the fact that this then was unanimously ratified by the Senate, it made it through public comment, which was a thing back then in newspapers. Boy, could we go back to that. Became then in full faith and credit effective as part of American law is more persuasive and compelling of showing what then this country is, i.e. not a Christian nation, than Jefferson's non-executive order letter to the Danbury Baptist Association. As far as why it seems as though Americans and other Western nations are distrustful of Muslims is, well, because Islam was the dominant civilization and imperial power prior to the 19th century. There was also the issue of a very long strain of ideological animus putting Islam in opposition to Christianity. Orientalism is another reason. And the general sense of foreignness or otherness of Islam. If you think about it, 1.7 billion Muslims are the largest single group on earth that comes close to all of Christendom, which is close to 3 billion. And particularly in this day and age, when there's nothing short of a moral panic about America's changing demographics, there is a fear among some that Islam is going to take over, helped in great measure by those who seek to traffic in exploiting fear, both politically and economically, without remembering that as far as our own history in this country goes, African-American Muslims predate African-American Christians by quite a bit.
Oh, sure.
Because, of course, slaves were then forcibly converted from Islam to Christianity.
What I find interesting about
this – by the
way,
just to clear this up, we forget when we talk about dates that because of boat travel, sometimes things took a long time
to get to a place.
So the Libyans signed the treaty when George Washington was president. Okay. By the time we did, John Adams was president.
Okay. All right. Yeah. All right. I remember reading that John Adams had signed it. I was like, I don't think Washington. Okay. Okay. So that's good. Thank you for clarity on that. And that does, make sense. I'm like, no, it was sent UPS. It would have been there the next day.
Sure,
I don't get
right.
it.
Next day.
But so all that said, to me, Saeed, interestingly enough, for me, I look at this and I'm going, okay, if Muslim nations and the Ottoman Empire and whatnot were kind of like the dominant empire at the time that a lot of this was going on. This statement at that time makes sense, right? Because at that time, are they a threat? Are they not a threat? Look, we don't have any quarrel with you. We're just trying to get our thing off the ground.
Well, I think
here,
at the
right?
time it was most important to say we aren't the Crusaders.
Right.
We aren't, we aren't coming.
But it was coming hot off of an issue with pirates, right? Tripoli Pirates was going.
The Barbary Pirates.
The Barbary Pirates. Pirates came up a little bit later under Jefferson, but I think it's also.
Okay, that was under Jefferson.
It's
okay.
also important to remember that at this stage, America was not an internationalist nation.
Right.
It did not really have a reach that was beyond its two oceans. And at the same time, it was still trying to map out what its relationships were going to be with its former colonizer, Great Britain.
Right.
And it was also a time of recognizing the rivalries in Europe. I mean, France was proving to be a bit of a volatile ally given the fact that it was going through its own revolution and reign of terror. So here we found relative stability on the part of the Muslim world, which was really encapsulated by the Ottoman Empire.
You know what is truly fascinating to me about this is even though my area of expertise is the early American Republic, almost all of my studies focused on those treaties that were signed between America and Great Britain, America and France, the Western world. This kind of episode, I think, might have gotten a footnote. I mean, it was a big deal for them, but historically for us now, it's kind of a footnote. But all that to say, back then, this seems like it would have been a concern enough that we were saying, hey, we don't have a quarrel with you. We're just trying to get our shit together, right? So in a way,
We had no navy at the time,
right.
I believe.
Well, we had a small one.
Well, no, but, I think we actually got help from France before
right.
then.
And we had, at that point, we had a navy. It. We didn't have a navy.
I think we had three right. fishing boats.
We took those ships apart so that slaves could build the White House.
Right. Oh, geez.
Well, what's really remarkable is that during the Spanish-American War, when there were rebellions in the Philippines, the United States implored the caliph of Constantinople, i.e. Istanbul, to exert his influence and authority as the titular head of the entire Muslim world to try to have those rebels in Philippines who happen to be Muslim to stand down.
Mm-hmm. Wait, are you telling me Istanbul was Constantinople?
I think it was Byzantine.
Byzantium.
Well, did you know that old New York was once New Amsterdam?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, they might be giants are coming again to St. Andrews, so we can go
Everybody's
verify.
Coming back.
But no, it is fat. I mean, and I'm saying this, and people who are listening say, oh, you know, typical liberal. I mean, look what just happened in New York a few days ago. Somebody from Uzbekistan, like, you hadn't even heard of Uzbekistan before Borat came out. Let's just be honest about that.
Which
right?
was Kazakhstan, but okay.
Was it Kazakhstan? Okay.
That yeah, was.
All right. I thought it was Uzbekistan. Okay. Anyway.
You think all the stands look alike?
I did. They all look. All
the Olympics, I think, is what most of us associate with Uzbekistan because that's the only thing most of us.
Oh, see, I have no idea what you're talking about.
I have no point of reference with the Olympics in Uzbekistan.
Winter Olympics coming up in February.
Either way, okay, so Uzbekistan is not normally one of the stands that's in the news. Nope. Let's just put it that way. That's a better way to reframe what I'm trying to get at here. So I know a lot of people would push back and say, well, you know, look, X, Y, Z is happening, and guess who's always the culprit? I was even able to talk to you, Saeed, about the portrayal of Muslim people in the show The Brave, right? The very first episode of the, I love military shows. I'm a pacifist, but for some reason I love military shows. And The Brave is about this it's a new show on, I think, NBC, but it's about this kind of crash group that's off the books, and they go in and they deal with issues that America can't actually be tied to.
Is it the SEAL Team 6 show?
Essentially.
Sounds like the SEAL Team 6.
Well, there's another show that's
the
essentially
the
just
millennia.
Like David Boreanaz is doing another show about SEAL Team 6.
Oh, is he?
So, yeah.
Okay.
That kind of deal.
So that would literally be the SEAL Team 6
yeah.
show.
Yeah. So, but the deal is the very first episode, the bad guys were Muslims, right? It's an easy sell.
Yep.
Right? And I said to Saeed, okay, how do you feel about the fact that the bad guys are Muslims, but there's a good Muslim on the team? And there are other people in Hollywood who are portraying the good right. Muslims who are being taken advantage of by the bad Muslims.
It's not that all Muslims are bad. Some of them are good. This is a good one over here.
Right.
It's a good Muslim.
But this narrative continues when I don't think it's an issue, but then there would be people who would push back and say, well, what about X? And they could point to, what, was it yesterday?
It was yesterday.
Well, they could point to yesterday, to yep. which I would have nothing. I would have nothing to say because that would be if that was their concern, if terrorism is their concern and they can point to terrorism yesterday, obviously domestic terrorism notwithstanding, that would be something where I go, I have nothing.
Well, I mean,
I don't have a horse in the race, I guess.
It depends on what register you're looking at or examining it through. I mean, the fact that some people are – and I'm not by any means discounting the carnage and the loss of life completely in an unnecessary way that happened in New York City yesterday. But the fact that people are either exercised, angered, or more afraid of an Uzbek with a Home Depot rental pickup truck mowing down eight people on the West Side Highway than they were exercised, agitated, or scared about some guy opening fire from the 32nd floor of a hotel room in Las Vegas or jeopardizing a school in Sandy Hook, Connecticut, or a movie theater in Colorado that was showing The Dark Knight Rises, or was it just
Dark
Knight
Rises?
Then I have to wonder, how do they examine issues? And is it really about terrorism, or is it about the identity of the actor that bothers them?
No, because absolutely. After the shooting in Las Vegas, it was too early to talk about guns. And the second day, it was too early to talk about guns. And the third day, it was too early to talk about guns. Within a couple hours yesterday, we're hearing tweets from the president saying, we're going to stop this whole, you know, immigration from this
lottery
system. Within hour, within minutes, I think it was. I don't think it was an hour. So obviously, you know, you kind of show your hand in situations like this. And the fact that it was so quickly, we're going to jump on people who are foreigners mm-hmm. to us. You know,
I said that to my wife. Now, here's one of the other things. If I were going to give any pushback on that, obviously the NRA, it's too early to talk about that. That came down. Now the NRA has their hand in the pocket of God knows how many of the politicians that are saying that. On the other side of that, people that you can otherize who don't have their hand in your pocket are brown people from the Middle East, unless they own oil. Right?
And did the NRA come to the defense of Flano Castile?
No.
They so didn't. It's not about even the guns at this point. It's about they don't look like me, so therefore...
I'm wondering, would the narrative change if there was some sort of major financial influence from the Muslim world other than oil? If there were a lot of people, if there was an organization of Muslim people that were backing Republican candidates, would the narrative would be different? I think it would.
I think the relationship, like with all things political, is prostitutional. And so that's when the money comes in. I think the point, Steve, that you make regarding the Second Amendment and the NRA is so important because
if it anything, is well taken, by the way. Yeah,
if anything, I think that the NRA has now become a church and is involved in being the arbiter of what is America's civil religion.
So let's move forward.
As of today...
And thanks, Saeed, by the way,
for
engaging that.
As of today, we're officially, and I will take issue with the word officially because there's nothing official about it.
WNSC says so.
We're officially
the day after Halloween, always.
Officially entering the 2017 holiday season. This will inevitably lend itself to culture wars over Christmas, holiday cups at Starbucks, nativity scenes on public property, Merry Christmas versus Happy Holidays. I understand we're allowed to say Merry Christmas again this year.
Yeah.
I started saying it in July.
Uh-huh. What do you make of the yearly kerfluffle over these things?
Important? Can't you just say what I wrote?
Nope. Important, okay. Overblown emotionalism, or somewhere in the middle?
Is it too crass to say it's stupid?
I was going to say that.
I feel as though I should probably be trying to be, you know, more a better of a wordsmith than that, but it seems to me that it's ridiculous every year. As a Christian, as a person who identifies with the Christian faith, I've never, first of all, when I go into Starbucks, they sometimes even say Merry Christmas to me. It's crazy. You know, they have a Christmas blend. They actually sell a Christmas blend at Starbucks. It's not like a Happy Holidays blend. It's a Christmas blend.
I think the most embarrassed.
Because I think it's got a shot of Hanukkah in it.
It's probably
the most embarrassed I ever got about this, and you all remember it, was 2 years ago, probably 2 years ago this week, when Starbucks released their holiday cup and it had the temerity to be red. And that's it. Red, and the world was on fire for like 4 days.
Well, I think last year they said, you know what, screw everyone. You can write your own message on here. Even care anymore. We're just selling you coffee,
and you can butcher it as we butcher your names. Absolutely. As you put it on your cup.
Okay, so from a personal standpoint, I would say that most people that I talk to outside of the internet, okay, were fairly reasonable about this. They're like, look, I mean, there were Muslim people who were like, look, I say Merry Christmas to my friends who are Christians. I mean, it doesn't bother me any, and they might say Merry Christmas to me, and I know that they don't mean me harm when they say that, even though they know I'm a Muslim, right? Or, you know, a Jewish person will say, hey, they said Merry Christmas to me, and I said Merry Christmas to them. It wasn't a big deal. Or they said, someone said Happy Holidays, I said Happy Holidays to them, because we all got our own holidays. To me, the kerfluffle, I'll use your word right there.
It's a fine word.
Yeah, it's kind of dumb. But on the other side, I look at corporate America, and we do live in, and I guess this is where I kind of agree with the second Bush administration, where they made it harder to have frivolous lawsuits against, you know, large corporations. Okay. I don't believe large corporations should be people, but that's something that a lot of these corporations have to watch out for. Like, oh my gosh, I can't. We got Happy Holiday. We said Merry Christmas, and it offended a bunch of people, and we got sued or we got boycotted because we seemed insensitive. And so, I mean, not holiday related. You got a big issue right now with Taco Bell coming out with their chocodila, and people are like, "Do you know what dila means in Spanish? Because that's not a good word, right? It's just insensitivity, right? They didn't know when they came up with this thing."
I watch a fair amount of TV, and I've not heard about what is the chocodila.
I eat a Taco Bell.
It's a quesadilla with Kit Kats melted inside of it. Right?
You're lying.
I am not. Google it right now. The problem is dila in Spanish is a double entendre, like a sexual double entendre. And so they were like, yeah, that meant they had nobody who spoke Spanish on their team when they
came
up with
this
idea.
Wait a second. All right. It makes more sense now that I'm thinking. So this
was it Taco Bell or was it Burger King? Somebody came with a chocolate dealer.
This isn't Kit Kats along with the chicken and cheese, right?
No, it's just it is just a dessert quesadilla.
Okay, fine.
Right. And so
that's your takeaway, by the way.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you have companies that are consistently dealing with getting egg on their face or offending somebody and the offended party making a big deal about it, which at the end of the day hurts your bottom line, right? So when you have someone that says, well, Merry Christmas offends me, and that person spends X amount of dollars and they can influence other people who spend X amount of dollars, maybe it makes more sense to just say, happy fucking holidays. You know,
well, you know what, though?
Maybe not fucking.
That's what you should say.
But isn't that obvious, though, that the problem is not in real life? The problem is manufactured? Because I don't know anyone who stopped going to Starbucks because of holiday cups. I don't know that they lost anything on the bottom line. I don't know any Christians that stopped going to Starbucks. I don't know that it was an actual issue outside of
maybe even the fear of it. So a few years ago with the holiday cup thing, they were like, let's boycott Starbucks. That language was out there. I'm never going to Starbucks again. I'm going to go to Big B from now on.
But did
right?
you know
then you go to Big B
that?
And you realize you're at Big B and you're like, I should go back to Starbucks.
Yeah.
So except their hot chocolate is legit at Big B.
Well, one of the things I think that we have to realize is that traditionally speaking, religion used to mediate the civil society space. Now it's corporations. And so instead of going ahead and howling at the moon that it's those pesky Jews, Hindus, Muslims that are wrecking Christmas, it's actually corporations that are becoming more, shall I use the word, ecumenical. A few years ago, Best Buy had the audacity to go ahead and wish its Muslim customers a happy Eid. And people went berserk over that recognition because, after all, this is territoriality. It's about who controls the discursive space to go ahead and say, I am not only expecting you to say Merry Christmas only, I'm entitled to it. And so that demand is occurring. Now, what's equally obnoxious is Muslims who go ahead and say, wow, Best Buy, they like us. They really like us. Seeking and getting corporate validation for them now belonging in American society, or Walmart selling halal meat in Dearborn or Ramadan cards. This is being contested not out of any sense of morality or immorality. It is amorality. It is about the bottom line for corporations.
Right. And make more money.
Exactly. And people are falling for this hook, line, and sinker. Why? Probably because their own religious traditions have become corporatized too.
Well, now on the other side of that, though, one of the things I brought up was nativity scenes on public property. That comes up every year. That is not a corporate thing. That is – this came up in the city of Warren. When I lived in the city of Warren, right where City Hall is, there's also a bit, public library, which is a great public library in there. But in this big hall area, they had a prayer station for a long time. And I think it was the Freedom From Religion Foundation said that's unconstitutional, made the waves in Warren. The mayor wasn't going to back down, and then finally he did back down and made a compromise, and so now there's the prayer station, but there's also an atheist reason station, right? But then when the holidays come around, it is...
You're saying there's a station where you can just be reasonable?
It's called the reason station.
That's we need that more right? places, I think.
Yeah.
So, it's just all atheist stuff. It's basically, why those guys over there praying for you are full of shit. That's what their whole their whole station is about. But
Merry Christmas.
It lends itself to that argument at Christmas time that comes up that is specifically holiday themed nativity scenes. The birth of Jesus, it's the baby in the stable and the Mary and the Joseph and the animals around them. Do we let that be placed on public property, taxpayer property? That is a big issue. And for years, because even though Christianity was not the official religion of the nation, that was not really truly frowned upon.
Well, and it was seen as a cultural imperative, and this is the whole code switching. Now, the Allegheny County case out of Pittsburgh tried to thread the needle on this by saying that the creche in a public display was not allowed inside the city hall.
When you say creche, do you mean Christ?
Is that the crush, the nativity scene.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
crush right, is sorry. A synonym yeah. for nativity
but, scene. Okay, all right. But didn't know that. Never heard
but
that.
But the menorah was considered to be secular enough that it was permissible. Now, in typical playground politics, when people say, oh, well, they got theirs, how come I didn't get mine? That line or that nuance is lost. Now, to me, a menorah is as religious, and I would imagine to the subscriber just as religious and sacred as the creche or the nativity scene is to the Christian. Does that mean that there has to be an accommodation for it on public grounds? Well, do so, but at your own peril. And you see these cases when it comes to crosses in military cemeteries mm-hmm. and all kinds of other situations. And it's always interesting to see how then other groups who don't necessarily have a symbol feel then the imperative that they have to put one out there because of FOMO, fear of missing out. Mm-hmm. So somebody decides that they're going to put a crescent moon and a star out just to be part of things. And now I think what's really adept is that the Satanic Temple of Detroit has sought to challenge what would be considered to be the usurpation of constitutional principles by saying we're going to go ahead and put a statue of Baphomet out there on state grounds at the state capitol, which then causes those who want to try to push the envelope by putting a nativity scene to say, all right, we're getting out of there because there's no way that we're right. going to have it next to us.
I do
something that's a satanic temple.
I find that, and that was a huge dust up here for a while when they unveiled it in a secret unveiling here in the city of Detroit. That's Baphomet statue.
That's but how I do it.
I do. They had to. I do find it strange and odd that we still, and maybe this is just me thinking very black and white here, but even in death, we want people to adhere to our way of life, our understanding of things. And so in a cemetery, like, oh, we have to take down Christian symbols, or we can't have Muslim symbols, or we can't have Jewish symbols because that could offend somebody. Like, everybody here is dead, right? And I get it. Look, I don't know.
Death
that,
is not the end, Calvin.
I don't know that going to visit, you know, my grandfather in Arlington Cemetery, seeing a star and crescent statue on my way would, like, really, really make me
but
offended.
That's, you know, that's forever, though. I remember with the story about Joseph Campo. You know, they actually put a fence between he and his wife in the grave because one was Catholic, one did not prescribe to the Catholicism, so they actually put a fence.
A wall of separation?
Mount Elliott and the other cemetery, Elmwood?
Elmwood, yes.
Where the Protestants, the Catholics could be buried because they couldn't be buried in the same
cemetery. So they're side by side, but the fence is right down the middle.
Yes.
That's why that fence is there?
Yeah.
Didn't know that. That's
yeah,
interesting.
There you go.
Because of two people.
Because well, not just because of two people.
Could have been
well,
people.
Maybe that was the origin, but the base the idea was Catholics and Protestants couldn't be
did
buried.
Did you learn that on a haunted tour last year or
I
something?
Did not. Okay, no. I just like stupid stuff, man. No, it's
wait,
did
you take a tour of Detroit from someone other than Calvin?
I wouldn't admit to it if I did.
I don't do haunted tours. I can
if
think
you
about
did,
cemeteries.
Though, next Halloween. No, but that's the idea. I mean, that religion, whether it's you know, Islam and Christianity, or Judaism and Christianity, or Protestantism and Orthodoxy and Catholicism, you know, even the end of life is not the end of that. So, I mean, you know, there's all kinds of whether it's racism or ethnocentrism or whatever you want to call it, you know, mine is better than yours is, you know, kind of universal, I think.
Yeah, most people don't care. I mean, I've grown up Muslim all my life, grown up in the West all my life, in the UK and the US. This was never an issue. I mean, somebody calls me or says to me Merry Christmas, or my saying to somebody Merry Christmas, it's a sign of respect. I think when people feel the entitlement to the exclusivity of it, that's where you have problems. But I think that's emblematic of the age in which we live right now.
Yeah. So if someone says to me, happy holidays, and I go, Merry Christmas. That's disrespect.
Now,
right?
is this an American issue, or is this a universal issue?
It's becoming more universal in the West.
Okay. Well, the United States dictates a lot of what happens culturally in the West, for better and for worse.
But I think this whole idea about economics, Steve, that you're talking about, you go to Harrods, which is sort of the iconic British department store, and everything is blinged out when it comes to Merry Christmas. There is no ambiguity of it. There's no Happy Holidays or anything. But Harrods is owned by Qatar.
Okay. So let's continue here. So churches, mosques, synagogues, and other places of worship are 501c3. nonprofit organizations. That might not be the right nonprofit.
That is.
I think that is correct.
Okay. So I know that there's different kinds. I found that out.
Way to cut yourself down.
This means, among other things, that they do not have to pay taxes and do not have to submit their finances to government for much oversight. Should houses of worship be tax exempt? Why or why not?
I think this goes against what Jefferson would have said. I think by not paying taxes, we are paying the ministers in a sense. I mean, the idea of charities, churches aren't charities. I mean, some of what they do is charitable. But I don't think that everything they do is charitable. So
I think that understanding of churches has changed then, because churches were classically understood as charities.
If you've gone to a mega church, you understand it's a small business.
Oh yeah,
bordering on something more than that.
It's run like a business.
It's run like a business, and some of what is happening is charitable, but a lot of it is it's paying a large staff.
Yeah, the church that I go to, which could be definitely classified as a mega church, does a phenomenal amount of charity work. Mm-hmm. And a phenomenal amount, which is completely internal, mm-hmm. and serves only the members of the church.
Right.
It also, as large as that church is, keeps a shoestring staff so as to not have to get involved in other government initiatives such as healthcare, certain types of healthcare that would have to be provided if you have X amount of employees. Yeah. I sat at the church and they had this meeting where they were talking through these issues with the leaders. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you deal with it was like a leadership program, so this one had to do with finances and taxes and things like that. And I brought that question up. There's a place in Rochester Hills. It's called Yates. It's a cider mill, right? And one of the members goes to this large church in Troy that Kent goes to, and he said, you know, the reason we keep our staff as low as we do is so we don't have to pay them insurance. But we're also able to pay them more because of it. And so it's kind of an interesting scenario that has to do with the tax.
More is an interesting term when you're taking the healthcare.
Yeah, but I see what you're saying. Though. But you know, cider and donuts keeps the doctor away.
But the tax exempt thing, though, for churches, for me, I go back and forth on this because the tax exempt status. I can't remember which president put it into place, but he was tired of churches essentially being used as political. Political pulpits, essentially. They are pulpits, right?
Is it Johnson?
I think it was Johnson.
Yeah.
So he gave them...
The Johnson Amendment.
So they switched from being able to speak about political issues and endorse political candidates from the stage to not being able to do that in exchange for not having to pay taxes, right? And so now you've got these organizations that don't have to pay taxes in the United States, but they're effectively neutered in terms of speaking on issues that have huge political import.
Neutered?
In a way, here's...
I think you meant spayed.
but I mean, I look at, again, historian looking at black issues. I look at the abolitionists, right? And the abolitionists were just straight up saying what was sinful, what the government, you know, needed to repent of, who to vote for, who not to vote for so that we could end this thing. And on the other side of it, the people who were pro-slavery were saying, you know, the opposite, but also endorsing and things like that. And so my thought as a historian is the church, houses of worship were integral in ending slavery, integral in ending Jim Crow. It's one of the things that I think the Black Lives Matter movement lacks is a spiritual core that Martin Luther King was able to tap into and just assumed everybody had.
But I think that's a misreading of the 501c3 requirements. There's nothing to say that someone cannot be up there on the pulpit and make a statement, a commentary about some social issue.
All right, I'm getting to what you can't do.
Yeah.
So yeah, you can definitely say, hey, you know what? I believe that abortion is wrong. Yeah, it's a political issue that people vote on. But I believe Jesus says this, or I believe Muhammad says this, or I believe the Jewish.
There's no Jewish pope.
Elohim. No. But here's the thing, though, Calvin, is that the statement can be made. The church or the mosque as an organization cannot then mobilize. And here's the irony. The people who want to lift that shackle are the same ones who want to go ahead and neuter unions. And essentially what you're doing is you want the church to become unionized. You want to have it be a block of people who then are going to lobby for some kind of legislative action. There's nothing to say that an imam or a rabbi or a minister can't go ahead and make a statement and then people take it upon their own initiative to go ahead
Correct.
And mobilize.
And so this is where I'm like, okay, the 501c3, the reason why I want it to stay in place, the practical side is, look, churches do a lot of charitable work, and if you tax them, they're going to be able to do a lot less of that charitable work. Okay, mm-hmm. There's that side of things. Churches, synagogues, mosques, temples, whatever. They're 501c3. They can do more good work in the world that the mainstream culture is not able to do, or they pick up the slack that the mainstream culture is not able to do, right? But then I also look at if you lift that 501c3 status and you start making churches pay taxes, the churches are going to perceive that as an attack, right? And what they are going to do then is incorporate. And when they incorporate, corporations for many, many, many years have learned the way to not pay any taxes in the United States. Apple doesn't pay taxes in the United States. They just don't, right? So the church would incorporate, and then they would be able to openly endorse candidates from the stage. They would be able to, now corporations can give as much money to any political candidate that they want. Corporations are able to do this at this point. I believe this was voted on, what, 2-3 years ago at this point now, because they're people, right? And so I think that the church would do that. So in that sense, I think that the 501c3 status should stay. But I do believe that something is lost by the marriage between church and government on this no taxing issue.
You know, two things there. I've been a consistent church goer for 21 years, and I've never not understood what people in my church were saying about politics. It's not said, but it's said. It's never a, you know, free will. You think about what you want. Here's all the facts, and you get to decide. No, it's always a peer pressure on how to vote, who to vote for. This is what we believe.
And never has it been clearer since Mark Zuckerberg's little experiment took off a few years ago.
So that's number one. Even though they don't say anything from the pulpit, we all know, anyone who pays attention. Number two, isn't this a commentary on how shot the Christian faith is in what you just said there about how they're going to incorporate and not pay taxes and say what they want? I mean, that's just an indictment that I agree with on the church itself, not the faith, but the church itself as an institution. And I think that's really tragic, actually. And that's why the asterisk remains when I say, identify.
I think there's another dimension.
I don't think a church and a mosque can get up and say, I think you should vote for Dennis Archer Jr. I don't think a church can do that.
They cannot now under 501c3, but I'd like to take this in a slightly different direction. I think right now what we're finding is that a lot of places of worship want to have their cake and eat it too. And I'm not talking about the whole debate going on with LGBT and bakeries. But the fact is that we've seen cases where those who have tax-exempt status based as religious organizations do not want to find then the government telling them you still have to go ahead and provide birth control and any kind of health insurance that you're giving. So they will take the exemption from the government, but they also want the government to stay out of their business. And I think that that asymmetric relationship is highly problematic.
Okay. Kent, your thoughts?
Well said.
Thank you. I got to think about it. I feel like I'm best used here as like Loki. Right?
Go ahead and ask the last question.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just thinking.
Loki from it, as in the Norse.
I was thinking the Norse.
Hoping not Marvel, but
not
but
the
Norse
bad guy from Avengers,
as opposed to being Loki.
Oh, low key. No, Thor's brother. Okay, so many religious people in America feel an increasing pressure to privatize their religion. Additionally, even though they're in the religious majority, many Christians have expressed a sense of persecution in recent years. Do you believe there is religious persecution in America today? If not, if so, how? If not, why? Why not? And Saeed, why don't you, as the Muslim in the room, explain to us how Christians are persecuted?
Sure, why not? Because, yes. You know, you've kind of essentialized me and marked me as being, you know, the token in the room.
Well done.
People of religious faith in general, I think, feel an encroachment by, I guess, increasing secularism, and they respond in different ways.
I would actually disagree with that, Calvin. Okay. I think that this is almost uniquely a Christian phenomenon, if I can say that, from my observation of it. There is not the internalization in the Muslim community, anything that's really detectable, that they are being persecuted from the standpoint that their religion is being mocked or marginalized. If anything, most Muslim Americans will contend that in America there's the greatest level of religious expression afforded to Muslims of various denominations and persuasions, and certainly that they're not being eclipsed by secularism per se. If anything, Muslims can say, we'll leave that where it is, and we can still practice within a secular space as opposed to the converse occurring.
Wouldn't you say that perhaps not on an official governmental level, but wouldn't you say that Muslims are culturally persecuted in America?
If they are, it's because there is a religious culture to America that is decidedly Christian. But I don't think that most Muslims will see this as being a threat. I think most Muslims, like most religious minorities, are extremely pragmatic. I've stated in many situations, and Calvin, you know this as well, that I will say that although I'm Muslim, I was essentially reared culturally Christian. I've always known that irrespective of what is said as the official position of a government as being secular, that I essentially set my watch to a Christian calendar. Mm. And that has never really been in opposition or disharmonious to the way that I lead my life. I mean, that would be, for example, like me driving on the wrong side of the road. You go in the direction of the flow of traffic, and if that's how it is, that's fine. If you don't like it, move to England where they do drive on the other side of the road. I think that this idea of creating a climate of saying that, A, the problem is that religion is being persecuted in America is a fallacy. There is perhaps the co-opting of religion by corporate forces. And I think that that's an entirely different discussion that needs to be had.
I think there's also a you're correct in that it's or I agree with you based on your response there that it's decidedly Christian phenomena that we're being persecuted. But it's something that I think I said earlier on the first half of the show, where kind of Christianity has had its day in the sun of being the dominant Christian religion, or the dominant religion of the United States, even if unofficially so. We kind of, oh yeah, America's not officially a Christian nation, wink, wink, right? We kind of always knew that it was. We're the best. We're the top of the hill. That's kind of deal. But now we're getting closer to the ideals of the United States Constitution, where Christianity is not necessarily enjoying the privilege that it once did. There's not an assumed narrative, and this can be problematic, where it was advantageous for Martin Luther King Jr. to be able to tap into this. Look, you all kind of believe this about Jesus. Maybe you should stop beating up black people. You know, you could tap into that, where the Black Lives Matter movement doesn't have that assumed narrative to tap into, which I think is it kneecaps it in a certain way. That's not the scope of what I'm trying to get at here, but there was this point where it was tacitly assumed that we shared this narrative, and that Christianity was the religion of the day, the soup du jour, right? And now that is not the case, and I think that people are afraid of losing that privilege, so to speak. We're losing this privileged space that we've had, and we don't like it. I think that is where these words of persecution come up. But if you compare it to like people being beheaded, or, you know, killed for their faith in China or whatever, just for having any kind of faith, that's real persecution. But I guess puppy love is real to the puppy.
It becomes a matter of a hub and spoke. I mean, if the centrality or the center of gravity of America is really a Christian view, then what that suggests is that all spokes lead into the hub. If that hub is dissipating, or in the minds of some, even though it's not going to happen, being replaced by something else, that is frightening for them.
Well, I wish we had more time. Obviously, always a pleasure having both Saeed and Steve here on the show. But thanks so much for listening to Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. Make sure to check out our website, leadingquestionsnow.com, where you can find all of our episodes from this season and the last two seasons, bios, a calendar of upcoming topics, and even suggest topics for us to talk about. If you're interested in bringing our program out to your college, university, or organization, email us at hello@leadingquestionsnow.com, and we'll get back to you. To our live listeners, thanks for tuning in. To those of you listening on iTunes, Google Play, or SoundCloud, thanks so much for subscribing. Please leave us a rating. And tune in next week, where Kent and I will continue our five-part series called The First. We'll be looking at the freedom of speech. See you next week.